This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, mass Black incarceration takes center stage in the Black American struggle. And Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley get bad marks when it comes to Black folks and on issues of war and peace. But first, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has released a new book titled Writing on the Wall. It's a compilation of his essays going back more than 20 years. Here's one of them from Prison Radio.
Gangsters in Blue, July 20, 1994. A ruthless band of criminals strikes a series of homes, robbing inhabitants of money and other valuables, threatening certain violence to those who dare to tell. A greedy group of thugs forces young people to hit the streets to sell drugs for them, and will beat and even shoot them if they don't produce profits fast enough. A brutal bunch of armed rapists attacks and sexually assaults a group of defenseless women. These and other events happened in New York and in Philadelphia recently, proof positive of an ugly crime wave in those and several other cities perpetrated by gangsters in blue, members of the police department. The recently released Mullen Commission report, which deals with several aspects of corruption, crime, and cop violence in the New York Police Department, tells of cops shaking down drug dealers, beating them, and shooting them. For instance, in one reference, the report noted that Officer Alfonso Compres not only allegedly robbed a drug dealer, but shot him in the stomach to steal his drugs. Not, the author might add, as evidence, but for resale, or even for his own use. Some cops, the report adds, are violent simply for the sake of violence. As an example, the commission document cited a case from Brooklyn North Precinct in which cops threw a bucket of ammonia at a person being detained in a holding pen. Another cop, known as the mechanic because he tuned people up, routinely beat folks up, visiting indiscriminate violence upon all, young or old, male or female. One cop testifying before the commission when asked by the commissioner whether such violence prompted complaints from aggrieved citizens replied, "Who are they going to complain to? The police? We are the police." And the killing of those who claim to serve and protect goes on. The deadly toll, 412 people killed by cops in 1976, 333 in 1984, 385 in 1990. They obviously haven't served or protected the thousands they've murdered over the years. So who do they serve and protect? They serve and protect the system, not the people. To the people, they are predators who take the health, the property, the freedom, and the lives of the very people who, through their tax dollars, pay their bloated salaries. They are blue uniform vampires who live on the blood and misery of the many. They are the best criminals of all. An essay from the new book, Writing on the Wall. This is its author.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from State Prison in Pennsylvania. Carl Dix is, along with Dr. Cornell West, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. We caught up with him in Cleveland outside a national conference of the Movement for Black Lives. The gathering is said to be financed to the tune of $1 million from the Service Employees Union, the Ford Foundation, and other liberal and Democratic Party organizations. Cleveland is also home to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but in terms of police behavior in the Black community, the city ought to have a Hall of Shame, so says Carl Dix.
That Hall of Shame point is very accurate. Right now, I'm on the first leg of the Rise Up October Stop Police Terror, Which Side Are You On? National Tour. And a grouping of people have come here who are part of this tour from New York City, from Detroit, Michigan, some folks from California. And we are here to take the message to the folks of Cleveland that murder by police is unacceptable, it must be stopped, and it will be our independent action that stops it. We are not looking for Obama, Holder, Loretta Lynch, any governors or mayors to do this, because they preside over the horrors that we have to stop. And while we every now and then get honeyed words from them about maybe they're going to do something, at most you get drops in the bucket, if it amounts even to that much, with a continuation of these killings. Here in Cleveland, because when we did a press conference to announce this tour, people said, well, why did you come to Cleveland? And I had to say to them, why wouldn't we come to Cleveland, the city where Tamir Rice, 12-year-old boy with a toy gun, was gunned down by police, who took all of 2 seconds to evaluate the situation and murder him. A city where Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell were had 137 police bullets fired at them for the horrific crime of their car having backfired near a police station. They were chased by dozens of cops who mowed them down and finished them off execution style. Tanisha Anderson, we could talk about. We could talk about Craig Lamont Bickerstaff and many, many other people. That's why we brought that our message here to Cleveland, and our message is a major step in stopping this will be New York City, October 24th, a national march to stop police terror. And we are on the road going throughout the country, drawing a huge dividing line over, do you stand with the people acting to stop this horror, or are you on the side of this horror of police getting away with murder is okay with you? Because there is no middle ground and no neutrality.
Well, Cleveland is a real case study in police oppression of the black community. It's a majority black city. I had one of the first big city black mayors back in 1967, has had other black mayors since, and a majority black city council, but it's working on its second consent decree with the Justice Department in a little over a decade. This speaks to what you referred to as who has presided over this mass incarceration and police terror regime, sometimes black folks.
Yes, that's a very important point to bring out, because Cleveland, in fact, people here tell me that Cleveland had the first black mayor in a major city. But be that as it may, that's a dubious distinction when you look at the fact that the terror that police rained down on people continued apace, whether the mayor was white or black. And we also have the national picture of it intensifying in a period when the president was black, when the Justice Department was headed up by a black man. And people need to look at that and from that perspective evaluate the effectiveness of looking to the federal government to come in to deal with the refusal of the local authorities to do anything about police brutality. Because the Holder Justice Department prosecuted exactly 0 killer cops in his about 6 years as the head of that department. 0 killer cops. Not a few, but 0. And we need to deal with that. We also need to look at these consent decrees, because not only has Cleveland had a previous consent decree, the Los Angeles Police Department was put under a consent decree more than a decade ago. It has continued to brutalize and murder black people and Latino people. And we need to look at the fact that this is built into the fabric and framework of this capitalist system. It is intensifying now because the capitalist system has less need for black labor in particular. They've moved those factories that they needed us to come out of the South to work in decades ago. They needed black people to work in decades ago. Well, they're now halfway around the world where they can find workers who they can exploit much more viciously and intensively. And that means that there are millions of people growing up in the ghettos and barrios of this country that they cannot profitably exploit. And their program for that is cops, courts, and prisons. That's what we're dealing with, and it amounts to a genocidal attack on black and broad sections of Latino people, and it's something that we must stand up and stop. We're going to need a revolution to deal with it once and for all, and that's something that as a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, I am working on, and at the same time, I am reaching out to everybody who sees police getting away with murder as something that is unacceptable and mobilizing them and working with them to mount mass determined resistance. That's what October 24th in New York City is going to be about. And it is unfortunate that we're doing this against the backdrop of something like what happened to Sandra Bland. But that concentrates this reality, because anybody who has seen the video of her arrest, you know, I don't even want to get to what they did to her in the jail, murder her, because she shouldn't even have been in that jail, you know, pulled over for improper lane change and literally brutalized, pulled out of the car and brutalized by the police because she did not know her place. You know, that's what it was all about. The cop saying, put out your cigarette. And her rightly saying, I don't have to. I'm in my car. I'm just sitting here. And the cop basically feeling like that's the wrong attitude. I'm in charge here. I'm the law. And they became not only her judge and jury, but her executioner. And this, to me, it took me right back to lynching and the several thousand lynchings that happened back in the day to a black person who got out of their place. And that's what they're saying to us today in so many different ways. There's a place for you, stay in it, or we will take you out.
President Obama is getting lots of accolades from some black quarters for being the first sitting president to set foot in a prison. And he's also commissioned a study on solitary confinement. Are these baby steps or no steps at all?
This is dust thrown in our eyes to take us off of what's really happening. Because look, Obama commutes 46 sentences of people in jail solely for drug possession, and it's federal prison. Well, there's 10,000 people in federal prison solely for drug possession. 46 out of 10,000, we're not even talking about a half of 1%. That doesn't even amount to a drop in the bucket. It's less than a drop in the bucket. But we're supposed to see that and begin to applaud and congratulate him. We're supposed to take the fact that he went to visit a federal prison, a prison that they cleared the inmates out of everywhere he went to, that this is a guy who's doing something. He set up a commission to study solitary confinement. At this point, we don't need a study of solitary confinement because there have been buku studies of solitary confinement that from different medical and psychological, scientific angles that all have pointed to this is a form of torture. And what he needs to do, if he's going to do something on this, is stop the torture, not study the torture. You know, because the Nazis studied their torture, you know, but don't talk to me about accolades for Nazis who studied torture. And that's all this comes down to, studying torture, not doing anything about it. This is like they stuck the knife 10 inches in your back, didn't even pull it out 1 inch, yet people are starting to applaud this man. People need to wake up to the reality that bodies are being crushed, spirits are being broken in the hundreds of thousands and millions, and a couple of concessions tossed out. only smooth the rough edges on the genocide. It does nothing to stop it and not even to slow it down. And we got to recognize what we're up against and act to stop it in a real, determined, and mass way, and not look for those who are presiding over it to toss us a crumb here or there to try to get us off of the case of fighting to stop what they're doing.
2 years ago, in fact, the Obama administration successfully went to the federal courts and prevented the retroactive release of about 5,000 prisoners who'd been convicted of crack cocaine laws. So he released 8 crack cocaine offenders among those 46 whose sentences were commuted, but 2 years before, he'd condemned 5,000 to remain in jail.
Yes, that's actually a very good point, you know, because there have been many steps taken to keep people in jail. They continue to send people into the dungeons that they call prisons, and then they open the door and let a few out, and we are supposed to applaud. We have to not be satisfied with crumbs and say, no, this whole thing is no good. This is not reformable. This is inhumane, illegitimate, and it's got to be stopped, referring to mass incarceration. And I say the same about the police terror that's a concentration of this program of suppression that mass incarceration is a very big part of. We are acting. We are moving. October 24th, which side are you on? Stop police terror. Go to the website stopmassincarceration.net, and the Rise Up October Coalition is putting up a new website called riseupoctober.org.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, outside the Movement for Black Lives conference in Cleveland. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, both running for the Democratic presidential nomination, seemed totally unprepared to answer questions from Black Lives Matter activists at a recent Netroots conference. O'Malley spent 8 years as mayor of Baltimore, where he oversaw a program of massive street arrests. Jill Carter is a young black lawyer and the most progressive member of the Maryland House of Delegates. She said O'Malley handled the experience with Black Lives Matter very badly.
Anyone in Baltimore knows that O'Malley has always been extremely uncomfortable when confronted with black people and black issues. Now, it sounds strange because he was mayor of a majority black city, but he was shrouded in protection when he was the mayor here. And it is true that at that time, when he ran for mayor, he ran on a tough-on-crime agenda, as so many Democrats and others did then. But while people wanted crime to diminish, they didn't know how he was going to carry it out. And so, of course, here in Baltimore, he carried it out through what wasn't completely new, but came from New York, Maple Linder theory, the broken windows, zero tolerance policy. From 1999 to 2006, when he was the mayor, 750,000 people were arrested. About one-third of those people were released without charges. In the category between one-third and one-half of all of those arrests, most of them were either illegal or unwarranted, meaning charges were so minor that they didn't warrant arrest, criminal or civil citation would have sufficed. But here's the issue. When all of this was going on, the entire political establishment supported him and supported the policies. Even when faced with the reality that it was destroying the city and it was destroying people's lives, it was absolutely irreparably harming the relationship between people in the community and the police department.
And when you speak of the entire political establishment in this majority black city, you're talking about black people as well.
Absolutely. I'm talking about the current mayor, who was the vice president of the city council. I'm talking about the former mayor, who was the president of the city council. I'm talking about the entire city council and the entire state delegation, the city delegations and state legislature in Annapolis, of course, with the exception of myself. And that becomes a little bit important because and speaking up at the time, my concerns were largely dismissed by everyone in the political establishment and also by all of the media. And so because of that, because no one wanted to hear it, no one wanted to write about it, basically I was very marginalized from that day to this day in my political career, because I was a new legislator at the time. And because of O'Malley, and again, he was shrouded in so much protection from media and the political establishment that no one wanted to address the problems. It's very important now, because now that Freddie Gray case caused so much notoriety for the city and the policing practices and the extraordinary benign neglect that's occurred in Sandtown, Winchester, and so many other communities over the years, now the political establishment that was largely responsible for creating the conditions and sustaining the conditions is charged with the responsibility of trying to fix that. And that's very problematic, because I would submit that they absolutely don't have any idea how to do so.
In other words, they don't have a plan.
I don't mean to laugh because it's not funny, but absolutely, it's pretty sad. You may know that the current mayor recently fired the police commissioner who was here for just over 2 years. It came from California. Most of us that know Baltimore knew that it likely wouldn't last, because of the fact that we know our city, we know our people, and we know that this is a tough environment. It's very the issues are complex. And coming as an outsider, it's not likely you're going to be able to grasp it. And then if you actually want to make change, you have a lot of obstacles in your way, from the FOP, the good old boy network, to even the political establishment that is very invested in the status quo.
You've described the firing of that black police chief as using him as a scapegoat.
Well, it certainly appears so. Of course, I'm not inside of the mayor's head. I can't begin to know exactly what was going through her mind. But the reason that it appears so is because up until the very day of his surprise firing, she was supporting him and promoting him. And so it did come as a bit of a shock. Now, the other interesting thing is that the crime numbers had been going up for just about her whole administration since he was the police commissioner, but none of that was compelling. I think the FOP probably had some influence in getting rid of him. They were urging her to get rid of him. I think that also all of the unanswered questions surrounding what happened when the uprising occurred, in terms of who made the decisions, no one here wants to take responsibility for what happened and how things went down where they did, not the mayor, not the commissioner, no one.
Well, in the aftermath of the disturbances, how are the police comporting themselves?
Very interestingly, the uprising occurred, I believe, April 27th or around that date. From that date until about maybe 2 weeks ago, the police were hardly making any arrests. Absolutely no drug arrests. Crime, the homicide number has gone up and up and up since that time. So just within the last 2 weeks, all of a sudden, there's this big clampdown, this crackdown, gun arrest, drug arrest. It's returning to normal. And so what my concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern, is that they're going back to the old way of doing things that didn't work. They may not be calling it zero tolerance, but it's zero tolerance. And I can tell you, I spend a lot of time, I'm a criminal defense attorney, but I also spend some time doing the pro bono bail hearing, the detention center. And I've seen it where within the last week or so, there's just an overwhelming number of cases where officers are claiming to have seen a gun and arresting 4 and 5 people for it. That kind of thing.
So they're reverting to form.
Exactly. And then, of course, I think so demonstrative of their complete lack of understanding of what this community needs for healing and progress is the fact that they created or announced about a week ago that they were forming a war room. And, you know, they didn't say thugs, but once again, this mentality of we're going to go after the bad guys, the worst, you know, the most violent people in the communities. Here's the problem. They have no idea who the bad guys are, who the bad guys or the good guys are. And that is because nothing has changed in terms of their community relations work, efforts, or strategy. Nothing has changed about the fact that over 80% of the police department does not live in Baltimore City.
And why would a civilian police agency have something called a war room?
Exactly. I think that, once again, this is the uprise in crime and the purported concern that there will be another uprising and we have to be prepared for the next riot, is what they call it, is what they're using to justify putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into a war room and into riot training and riot gear. I really believe it's a bit of a pretext for the further militarization of the police department here, as is happening all over the country.
You've described the behavior of the elected officials, the Democratic Party, but what about the grassroots? What level of organization has developed there?
Some of what's going on the ground with people and organizations has actually been very inspiring and very beautiful. There's been a lot of collaboration from, you know, what they used to say, the grassroots, the trash roots, to people that are more part of more established organizations. And there's some organizations that have formed here that are very inspiring, such as Be More United, Baltimore United for Change. It's a collaboration of a whole bunch of people, organizations, clergy, everyone. That's an example. But the concern, of course, is now everyone from the governor on down wants to discuss pouring money into programs and organizations to fix Sandtown Winchester. First of all, as if Sandtown Winchester is the only impoverished, destitute, neglected area of the city. It's far from that, but it is one that does need some resources and some attention. So the concern is that, once again, you will see money and resources being funneled through organizations and nonprofits, where the people that run the nonprofits make high salaries and everyone gets paid off of the continued problem of the poverty and the lack of everything. What some of us are doing, including some members of Baltimore United for Change and then others, is trying to work very hard to press the issue that people in the communities need to be the arbiters of these resources, that people in the community know best what the community needs and what they need, and so it shouldn't be dictated to them by others that come in, you know, poverty pimps and others that come in just to benefit from their pain.
You, of course, are a state legislator in the fourth blackest state in the country. What was the reaction statewide, specifically within the House of Delegates, to the developments this spring in Baltimore?
Well, interestingly enough, and I don't know that Maryland or Baltimore is that unique from other political environments across the country, but it certainly is a very repressive one for anyone that wants to actually be any kind of agent of change. For me personally, being a black female coming from a civil rights background, not ever really being embraced by the Democrat political establishment, it's been very difficult. I've been very marginalized. And it's interesting because before Freddie Gray, even before Trayvon Martin, before we knew that every 28 hours a black person is killed by law enforcement in America, I've been pushing for changes and reform since I've been in legislature and policing, mainly because of the O'Malley zero tolerance that would not result in those people being arrested and having records that are now unemployable and their lives are completely handicapped, harmed permanently because of those arrests. But at any rate, the legislature has been completely resistant to change. The leadership of the legislature appears to believe that the FOP and other police agencies are in control of them, that they dictate what they will do. They govern the legislature rather than the legislature governing them. And so the legislature refused to pass any police accountability or reform bills this past session, even though I championed many other legislators, championed them, and hundreds of people came to Annapolis to testify on these various pieces of legislation. They were all categorically ignored. And then Freddie Gray happened, and a legislature or leadership decided, well, I guess we have to do something. The cameras are on us. We're getting national attention. We have to do something. So they formed what they call a legislative work group to formulate legislation to improve police-community relations. I'm not a part of that group. No leader of the Black Caucus is a part of the group. No legislator that was an advocate for change, only legislators that were opponents to change in policing, are made part of the group. So that's where we are in Maryland. It doesn't bode very well, and I don't have any high hopes. Any change is going to have to come from continued efforts from the people. It is not likely to come from the political leadership.
Well, let's talk about the change that might come from the people. You're a political activist, an elected official. You come from a family of activists. Do you see a movement emerging that is worthy of the name movement?
I will say that I do. I don't believe that we are there yet. but I definitely see more movement than I've seen in a very long time. One of the things that's very encouraging is the young people that are really taking leadership roles in a lot of these organizations, a lot of the movements, and that are speaking up. And what's really interesting is that they make it very clear that the only thing that older people can do that have been complicit in these circumstances can do is get out of their way. So we have elections coming up next April in the city, from the mayor on down through the city council seats. And I've already seen it. It's not even August yet. I've already seen about 8 young people that are announcing and that they're running, and they're actively already out campaigning and door knocking. It's been speculated that the current mayor is in huge trouble because of her poor handling of many things. So I expect there to be a lot of challenges to the current mayor as well.
And what about you? Do you have any plans beyond being a delegate in Maryland's House?
Truthfully, growing up in Baltimore, there's nothing that I've ever wanted to do more in my life than right the wrongs of the city that I knew existed from the time I was a child until now, and that I've seen only grow worse in many years. Now that I've had a personal experience within politics and seen how 99% of it is the result of political misleadership and a political establishment that is invested in keeping the status quo, keeping widespread poverty, keeping racism, classism, and all of those things alive, it is very difficult for me not to want to run for mayor. And the reason is not so much of a personal ambition, but it's because of my strong desire to empower our people and to see us have what we've been deprived of for so long, which is access to opportunity in our own city. So the answer is, I am giving it some thought. It would be a people's campaign, and it would be the people controlling the office of the mayor and the policies of the city, as opposed to a few political insiders that benefit from the current conditions.
You would see your campaign as part of the movement.
Absolutely. That's exactly how I see it. In fact, some of the inspiration to even consider running is coming from the people in the movement that desperately want change.
That was Maryland House of Delegates member Jill Carter. Veteran activist and scholar Paul Street was one of the few political observers who concluded early on that presidential candidate Barack Obama was a center-right corporate politician who would not voluntarily lift a finger to change the black economic condition. Paul Street lives in Iowa City, Iowa. He's also been a longtime observer of Bernie Sanders, the nominal socialist who's running for president as a Democrat.
You know, I've seen a number of Bernie Sanders campaign speeches now. I've seen a couple in Iowa. I've seen the YouTubes of a very popular one in Madison, Wisconsin. He doesn't say socialism. He kind of identifies himself with the social democratic states of Scandinavia, particularly Sweden and Denmark and Norway. Does not refer to himself as a socialist. And unlike most serious socialists that I've known, like serious socialist presidential candidate named Eugene Debs back in the day, I haven't heard him mouth the phrase capitalism once. It's always about the billionaire class. He's running as a populist. He's not running as a socialist. So he bangs on the billionaire class. He goes after the Koch brothers. He talks a lot about the Citizens United decision as if the United States wasn't already a corporate-managed plutocracy before that decision. I mean, it's a terrible decision, but he really harps on it. He harps a lot on the Republicans. You know, one event I went to early on in Iowa City, I mean, it was left to a junior professor in the crowd to raise his hand and say, but Bernie, you know, the Democrats are also part of the corporate oligarchy, which, you know, can be shown very easily with research in terms of votes and money and campaign finance, all of that. So it is kind of nominal. I guess the most you can say about him in democratic socialism is, you know, in being a socialist, is he doesn't run from the label when a talking head of the media says it to him. He's not really running as a socialist right now.
And certainly he is a nominal independent in that he has ranking within the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, the first talk I heard from Sanders out here in Iowa, of course, Iowa is the basic ground zero of all this candidate madness that we're supposed to just go crazy over every 4 years. And so, I mean, we get them all out here constantly. anyway, out here in Iowa, I've seen Sanders kind of project this history of himself as really a committed and independent third-party guy who really wrestled, he says, with the decision whether he could stay in independent or to run for the presidency within the Democratic primary process. And he finally came agonizingly, sort of the way he talks about it, to the pragmatic decision that third-party candidates would never get anywhere in the national presidential election, and therefore he'd have to go within the Democratic Party. And what that leaves out is that Bernie has been a de facto Democrat for 15 years or thereabouts. So he was a technically independent, sort of left-styled mayor of progressive Burlington, very white and progressive and left liberal Burlington, Vermont, in the Reagan era in the 1980s. But he got his head kicked in when he went for a Congress. So he went for the one seat in the House of Representatives, and he and the Democrats split the vote between them, and the race went to a Republican. He was out of office for the first time in 10 years, and from that point on, he sort of cut a deal with the Vermont Democratic Party, whereby he would run as a nominal independent, and the Democratic Party wouldn't actively oppose him. And he would obstruct third-party building in the state of Vermont. He would sort of work against any real attempts to develop alternatives to the two leading capitalist parties. And that continued into his career in the U.S. Senate, where when he's running for the Congress, which is every 2 years, and he's run twice for the Senate, he has this deal with the Democratic Party where he gets to be listed on their ballot in the primary election. And then he wins it. He wins the Democratic primary. He used it for the House, and now he wins it for the Senate. And then he technically turns it down. I mean, he's featured in the campaign stops for these races above the Democrat. It's usually some sort of lame Democrat who's left of him, who tries to run for the office, and then who can't, isn't even allowed up on the campaign. And he's been a senator and voted in ways that are very friendly, particularly on foreign policy, particularly on militarism. He's voted, you know, with Bill Clinton and voted with Barack Obama on military matters in the U.S. Senate, and he did it in the U.S. House. And as a senator, he's got a seniority deal just as if he were a Democrat. If he plays along with the Democratic majority whip, Dick Durbin, on procedural votes, he's supposed to be nominally independent on policy votes, but he very rarely even tries to vote outside the Democratic Party on policy votes. So while he plays ball on the votes that come up, he gets the same sort of seniority as he would if he were a member of the Democratic Party. So, you know, this notion that all of a sudden Bernie has come into the Democratic Party is very, very misleading. He's been a de facto Democrat forever.
It seems like an elaborate charade of independence, but he's made a strong verbal vow that he will support whoever is the Democratic Party's candidate for president, meaning Hillary Clinton.
Right. Bernie has referred to Hillary Clinton as his good friend. You know, you kind of wonder what kind of socialist is going to be a very good friend, a self-described good friend of this militant hawk, military hawk, and abject, you know, Wall Street-financed, multimillionaire, corporatist Democrat. And if it was such an agonizing decision, supposedly, and he really, his real history, in essence, was about being independent, and he just made this kind of last-minute, pragmatic, here's the only way to go decision to run within the Democratic Party, it seems odd that he would be so eager to say right out the box and in advance and from the beginning of his announcement of his candidacy that he will, in the end, personally support, and, you know, and what that means is tell his delegates, if he has any primary delegates, and his voters, you know, that he will be supporting Hillary and telling them to support Hillary, apparently without even asking for anything in return. I mean, that's sort of doubly disturbing. So, you know, this is all kind of a nice phenomenon where people will get to vote for a social Democrat in the primaries, and then it'll all be over. It's all over by April. Sort of surrender and say, because he doesn't want to be a spoiler, right, Ralph Nader, he said. And this is without even asking for anything. I mean, I could almost see someone making a case for taking that tactical move. If he were going to demand something, Dennis Kucinich at least tried to make a show of demanding a, was it a Department of Peace? He claimed he was going to try and get a Department of Peace within an Obama White House. But there's no efforts in that regard. It's unfortunate, but you're absolutely right.
And as a senator, Sanders has supported the continued funding of the military-industrial complex, something that we don't associate with a socialist or even a good progressive.
Well, you know, I've sort of gotten some flack back when I point that out with emails, and then they send me to something Sanders said or a vote Sanders made. I mean, the furthest he's ever gone is to join a few other senators, including Republicans, in occasionally making a statement against bloat, you know, and against exorbitant Pentagon programs. But that's not particularly left, and that's been done all the time, and you could be on the right and do that, and some of the senators who do that are on the right, and furthermore, he was an advocate of a classic Pentagon bloat program called the F-35 fighter jet, which was widely critiqued by Pentagon spending watchdogs, but which happened to have a round base with a lot of jobs associated with it. It happened to have a base in Vermont that Bernie supported. And the other piece of flack I've gotten tons from liberals who like me on this issue is, well, he can't be perfect on all the issues. You know, he's for single-payer health insurance, which I'm for. Well, you know, because Bernie was really for it, then why didn't he run as an independent to be the next governor of Vermont, and he could actually implement and redeem single-payer probably in the state? It's a good thing. He's for Employee Free Choice Act, union organizing, pro-union. He's for massive, huge green jobs programs, maybe even sort of green. You know, he talks in a very forthright way about the need for infrastructure and to tackle climate change. It's a good thing. But this problem on the empire and not having any real critique of the Pentagon system sort of renders a lot of that progressive domestic policy agenda that he has somewhat null and void, simply because the Pentagon system eats up 7% of all federal, you know, discretionary spending. There is this fundamental conflict between guns and butter, and between paying for a military system that accounts for half of the military spending in the world, that maintains 1,000 military installations around more than 100 countries around the world, you know, in which, by the way, that military system has the single biggest carbon footprint, global warming contribution of any institution on Earth. His climate, his environmental agenda, his social anti-poverty agenda really don't have a chance of even ever getting out of the gate until we tackle that empire. And, you know, this was something that Dr. King came to understand very well by 1966 and 1967, including in his famous Break the Silence speech at Riverside Church in 67, where he pointed out that the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. He said, and that was no less true today than it was true in 1967, and where he pointed out that a country that spends more money on military defense, so-called defense on empire, than on social uplift is courting spiritual death. Bernie's got some spiritual death in that regard, and you really see it in very ugly kinds of ways when he has done things in the past like aggressively oppose peace activists in his own home state by supporting the criminal bombing of Yugoslavia on false pretenses under Bill Clinton in 99, when he supports Obama's invasions of Afghanistan, of Syria, of Yemen and Somalia, when he supports the drone war and the targeted assassinations, and last but not least, when he becomes an abject apologist for the genocidal, racist Israeli assaults on the children and other innocent civilians of Gaza. He's defended Israel's attacks on Palestinians on numerous occasions.
There is another candidate of the left, Jill Stein of the Green Party, although she may not be on the ballot in many states. What's your analysis of her impact in this election season?
Well, you know, I don't know how much impact she's going to have because the deck is so stacked against third-party voters. It just so happens that she is very much more forthright about some of the issues that Sanders won't talk about. She will be on the ballot in many states. I personally think there's no excuse not to vote for her, not to at least make a protest vote. And I don't care if I live in a contested state. I've heard this whole argument. You can vote how you want in a state where we already know how it's going to go, but in a contested state, you got to make sure the Republican is don't get in. Well, you know, I'm not going to be guilt into that. I will do my usual thing and vote for either the Ralph Nader or, in this case, the Jill Stein. And I'm sorry, there's no excuse for people not to go to the Green Party platform and read her policy agenda, which is fundamentally about key things that are desperately needed to save life on Earth. I mean, she highlights the Green New Deal. There's some Green New Deal in Bernie, but she's much more detailed about it. But she actually includes the Pentagon defense cuts and the Pentagon budget cuts that would be required to actually make the billions and billions of dollars of investment in green jobs and energy reconversion and infrastructure broadly understood. She actually promises to make those tough decisions. And she talks about the police state, and she talks about institutional racism and all that. And, you know, if we didn't have these names and these parties on these candidates, and if we just ran, we just ran policy platforms for our offices, I think people would be amazed. If we took the money out of it, and we took the media out of it, took all the major party labels out of it, and we just ran a contest between policy platforms, which is what people ought to be focused on, not what kind of haircut a candidate has or whether he's got big ears or not, but, you know, policy. Isn't that what we're supposed to care about? If we did that, we just ran policy elections, I think people would be amazed to see the Green Party would sweep.
Paul Street's latest book is titled They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. Philadelphia's Temple University is under the most intense scrutiny. The university has long been accused of fostering gentrification of the surrounding black community. Comedian and accused sexual predator Bill Cosby was forced to resign from Temple's board of trustees. And now Cosby's lawyer, Patrick O'Connor, is under pressure to step down as chairman of the university's board. Temple's once well-respected African-American Studies Department is a shambles under Dr. Molefi Asante, who changed the name to the Department of Afrocentricity after firing the Du Boisian scholar and veteran activist Dr. Anthony Montero. This Thursday, July 30th, a protest will be held on Temple's campus demanding reinstatement of Dr. Montero, rebuilding of the African American Studies Department, and an end to displacement of black and poor people in the neighborhood of Temple. We recently had a discussion with Dr. Montero. The conversation began with the situation in Greece, where the Syriza party recently capitulated to the demands of the bankers that control the European Economic Union.
I agree. They have discredited themselves among the people and among the European left, and in a lot of ways, I think the global left, but it was a wake-up call. It was a wake-up call very similar to the way Obama has become a wake-up call for the left in this country, that path to social transformation in the era of austerity does not work.
What path are you speaking of?
A path of social democracy, of traditional European social democracy, what they often call Eurosocialism, led by the petty bourgeoisie and upper middle class intellectuals. That is not the path. It's going to have to come literally through mass organizations of the people, be they unions, social movements, and so on. That's the only path. So Syriza may have been a learning experience for the Greek people and for the European left.
Syriza didn't even prepare to take over the Greek banks, much less to leave the Eurozone.
They never intended to. As it turns out, they were not honest with the people. They promised things that they never intended to do, at least the top leadership, that is. So they didn't do that, and then they end up with this agreement with the German bankers and the European Union that is worse than anything they ever signed in the past.
You've already said that you see comparisons between that kind of left-ish behavior in Europe and in the United States. Could you be more specific about the American left-ish scene?
Well, you know, if you remember 2007, 2008, most of the left, black, white, Latino, got behind Obama and joined with the center and liberal forces and even conservative forces in the Democratic Party to support Obama and then to apologize for Obama for about 7 years. I think a good part of the left has learned a lesson. And for that reason, Bernie Sanders is having a real problem rallying the left to his side. And if you look at social media and the internet, there's a lot of criticism of Sanders and a real kind of critical attitude towards electoral politics, period, especially presidential politics that are controlled by big money. So I think this wake-up call, I can't say where it is going. I can't say where the European and North American left is going. But what is clear, that the masses of people, be they in Greece or be they in the United States, are not waiting for the left to make up its mind about tactics and strategy. I think what we see here in the United States is an evolving movement. I don't think this movement against the police state is going anywhere. It's just going to grow. I think we're going to see the same thing in Greece, and I think Greece will be in the vanguard of what happens in Europe.
I can offer a comparison between Syriza's behavior and leftish U.S. behavior back during the Occupy Wall Street period. These activists railed against the banks and came up with great slogans involving percentages, 1%, 99%, but they never called for an outright nationalization of the banks.
That's very, very true. That's very true. But it took the humble people of Ferguson, Missouri, to spark a movement, not the kind of elite middle class people that inspired Occupy. And what we see is a different class basis. The people of Ferguson are the African American proletariat. The people of Baltimore are the Afro-American proletariat. So it takes that kind of mass base to build a movement. It takes the upper middle class to protest without ever taking the bold steps that are necessary. So I think we see this metamorphosis, this evolution, and I think we are looking at a great movement that has the potential to transform this society.
You said that you don't know where the movement is going, but you also indicate that you believe the police will provide the fire, the fuel, for this movement's momentum.
Well, when I said I don't know where it is going, let me be clearer about that. I don't know what the tactics will be. I do know that the goals will become clearer. When I say tactics, whether there will be urban uprisings like in the 1960s, I think there will be instances of that. How widespread, it's difficult to say. Will there be the development of survival programs in cities like urban gardens where people will feed themselves, where there will be cooperative buying, where there will be education of the youth and daycare and so on, what the Panthers used to call survival programs? Will there be community policing and communities arming themselves to defend themselves? Definitely. So what we are looking at is a movement that in many ways combines the tactics of the civil rights movement, mass marches, civil disobedience, shutting down things, putting your body on the line, combined with programs and ideas that did not always crystallize in the Black Power movement, but were thought about in the Black Power movement, like survival programs and like self-defense in the community. So I think this synthesizing of some of the most important and best features of the civil rights and Black Power movements will, in this period, in a new movement which will call for fundamental change in not just the economy, but in the nature of governance in this society. And it will be essentially an urban movement of the urban working classes led by African Americans.
The scenario that you just described presupposes great struggles within the Black community.
Absolutely. And that is already happening. And that is why the youth who are in the forefront of this movement have rejected the electoral political process. They have rejected it in favor of community and mass development and organization. Now, what is missing is the ideological component of the mass movement, and that is what more attention has to be paid to.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.